so much for joining me today, you guys. We're going to be talking about something that I really, really love, which is story structure. So this is something that I really like to talk to travel writers about, because so many travel writers have come from other walks of life. Perhaps you've come from other parts of the travel agency or system, or you've come from education. I myself used to be in a university in the office for sending students abroad for internships. And some of you have absolutely no travel connection at all and no literature connection. And so this is something that a lot of us get into, having our own blogs and learning about web writing and learning about WordPress, but we don't learn these fundamental building blocks of putting a story together. But the beautiful thing is that once you know them, you're never going to forget them, and it's going to make writing your stories so much faster. So that's why I'm really excited to talk to you about that today. So specifically, a couple things that we are going to talk about are, what is a story arc? What is a narrative is another name for it. Like, what does that all mean? What is a story in the first place? And particularly, how do we take these fiction constructs of what a story is and put it onto the things that have happened to us in our life on our trips? And specifically, we're going to look at some ways that those play out in travel articles, as opposed to how they often play out in other story settings. So often when you hear story, you think that means fiction. And there's a whole beautiful world of writing and analysis and also literary journals around this concept of the nonfiction narrative, which is what we're talking about today, taking a narrative structure and putting it on something real, something that has happened in real life that has sprung up. And the thing about nonfiction narrative is that a lot of things that have been popular stories throughout the centuries, millennia, are inherently nonfiction narratives, even if they've taken on a certain veneer of fiction just through their popularity. And these conferences, I really recommend, if you have the choice between going to just one conference in a given year, don't necessarily just look at going to a travel blogging event where you're going to meet other travel bloggers or other travel writers. Send yourself, for educational purposes, to a writing conference, and especially to a nonfiction writing conference. It will just blow your mind how much you will learn. I've started going to these in the last couple of years, working on writing books, and it's just a constant help to me and also to the people that I pass this on to, learning these structures. So we're going to talk about the general structures as well as how they work in the travel world. And then I'm going to give you a couple specific ones for different travel article settings, as well as different types of travel articles that you can just take home and use on your own work going forward. So in terms of, I didn't update my bio this week, but in terms of this story structure that we're going to talk about today, like I said, I've really devoted a lot of time to this. I think it was about 2.5 years ago, I took kind of like a professional sabbatical after having been working as a freelance travel writer for about 5 years. And I took a couple months to just wholly study story structure in travel writing, especially in book length form, but also in shorter functions. And I basically just gave myself an MFA. I read tons and tons of stuff from all sorts of, you know, great writing academy type sources in terms of the nonfiction, as in the people talking about how to do this stuff. I read all these books. And so I really am bringing to you guys something that for a while was not exactly a hobby, but a sort of a personal thing that I was doing on the side for several years, to really dive into how story structure works in the travel writing setting specifically. So that's why I'm so excited to talk to you guys about this today. So like I said, before we dive into the specific structures that we can use for travel writing, it's really important that we all get on the same page about the concept of narrative, about the concept of the story arc. And first of all, it would be really helpful for me to know, and I'm going to put this in the chat box as well, please let us know how much experience you have with the concept of narrative. like I said, I, for myself, had to take some time off from my journalism, so to say, and really study this, because even if you have been a journalist working in a newsroom, or even if you've gone through journalism school, there's a lot of things that you study around, you know, research, getting sources, details, you know, how to put those things together, but you don't necessarily look at this story structure because it's thought of as something that you only need for longer pieces, or it's not journalism. Fiction and journalism are absolutely different, right? And that's where this whole world of nonfiction narrative comes in. And so there's a bunch of you on the call today that actually do have a background in fiction, which is great. And so it seems like we're split kind of through the middle. And that's really great to know. I know some of you, just looking through the folks that are on the call, I know some of you, I've chatted with you in the past, and you have some pretty robust background in this type of writing. But just for the sake of everybody getting on the same page, I'm going to go through some different story structures here as well. And so for those of you that do have this background, they're probably going to be a bit familiar to you, but I'm going to talk about some of the pitfalls as well of applying these structures in the nonfiction, and specifically travel, and specifically feature setting. So hopefully even this part where I'm going over the story structures will be informative for you guys as well. And so Maria, and I'm not sure which Maria this is, there's a couple, but someone just said they read Storycraft by Jack Hart. And this also came up at a retreat that we ran recently. This is I believe Storycraft is the new one that just came out. I have another one that I think is called The Story Bible. And there's a couple things like this that are really, really great, but Storycraft is highly recommended. The one that I have it's kind of looks like a workbook, and it's 8.5 by 11 size, but it's about 2 inches thick, even at that print size. And he literally goes through on every single page of your book, because this is for book-like things, what should happen in terms of the character being afraid, or the character being surprised, or the character meets this person. And it's not unusual in the world of book-length writing for there to be these very specific guides. I have a writing friend from writing conferences who is a professional romance book writer. She also writes some other things, but in romance, there's all of these ridiculous guidelines. Like if the main female protagonist hasn't kissed the male protagonist by this page, that's not okay. And it's down to the page. It's not just about arcs. And so what we're going to talk about, yeah, someone's asking what's the name of the book on story that I have, and I'm going to have to look it up because I'm talking to you from a hotel room in London right now, and it's in the library at the retreat house. So I'm going to have to check on that when I get home, and I'll mention it either in the newsletter or on the blog somewhere, because I just don't know off the top of my head. So Storycraft, though, that Maria mentioned, she has a journalism background. She has an MA in journalism, and she's working on a really cool book right now. And she said, this is a really great resource if you have a journalism background and you're transforming into narrative nonfiction. And I totally agree. I've heard some other great reviews of that as well. So we're talking about these fiction archetypes, right? And how they translate into travel features. And one of the things that I did in preparation for this call, I always do, even if it's something I know well, I always go out before the webinars and do some research and try to pick up some tips for you guys that I don't already know, or see the way that other people are teaching it, right? And something that I did this past week was to look for blog posts, anything really, on how to write travel features. Because I know this is a question that I really get a lot from you guys, even from people like several of you that I see on the call today that have really robust writing backgrounds, is how to translate that to this 1500 word journalistic but narrative format. And I was actually really surprised at the dearth of information that was very structural and informational and procedural about how to go about that. And I guess I shouldn't be 100% surprised, because the whole reason that we started this enterprise of Dream of Travel Writing in the first place is because people aren't out there telling you exactly how to do these things. But I pulled a couple, let's call them key phrases, from some of the resources that I came across that I found interesting. This is in the realm of how to write a travel feature article, okay? So some of them you'll see here are deceptively simple. They seem like they should be correct, but this is the extent of the direction. So here's one: develop your story thematically or chronologically, but keep it moving. Now, I feel like the concept of developing a story thematically to me is so obtuse, like trying to think of how to put together a story thematically that's feature length and have it be interesting without having it be a roundup. I just see the reader losing interest. Chronologically can also be a problem, and we're going to get to that in a little bit. But keep it moving. This seems like the kind of direction that you get from an editor that wants rewrites, and you're like, what does that mean? I don't know how to do that. And you know right away that whatever rewrite you send her, she's going to send you back because it doesn't make sense. Like I said, these directions, you know, but keep it moving. That's the kind of thing that an editor might say to you, and you're like, oh my God, I have absolutely no idea how to interpret that direction. So another one that we're going to talk about, I have a whole slide just on endings, because that is a question that I both get and don't get. I think because a lot of people don't get to the ending because they get scared along the way. But we'll, like I said, we're going to talk more about endings. But I just loved this little bit of direction. End with a lesson or discovery or a personal transformation. Like they said, end with it, but not how to get there in the first place. And that's one of the things that we're going to talk quite a bit about, because that's really the whole point of this structure. And just ending with the lesson is actually one of the biggest faux pas that you can do that makes your stories not ring true. Now, this one I really loved. A feature writer for a travel magazine or say for your own blog is in the business of selling one thing and one thing only, fantasy. Now, this is kind of akin to this concept of armchair travel, that you're writing a story that is not necessarily replicable by anyone else. But the whole problem that I have with this is that fantasy is actually a tough sell. If you think about fantasy-oriented television shows or fantasy-oriented books, they tend to be things that are known for having a cult status, but not necessarily a wide appeal. And one of the best things that you can do with your feature writing, with your narrative and long-form writing, is to make it universally applicable. And I actually don't have this quote on any of my slides, so I'll just say it now. But one of my favorite quotes about this type of writing is from Maya Angelou. And the essence of it is that nobody remembers what you tell them. They only remember how you make them feel. So if you think of nothing else in terms of your story, just always keep that in mind. Is this bit in my narrative making somebody feel something? And we're going to get into how to do that. And just this last quote here, for those of you who are listening in by phone, your first job is to decide on the particular story you want to tell and the events which make up that story. Now, this I got in here, not in a joking way, but because it's so important. So many people sit down with a whole boatload of research and their trip in their head to try to write a story, but they don't know which story they want to tell. And let's look at what I mean by that. So I have a friend who is a documentary filmmaker who teaches, or rather he sometimes does talks on story arcs. And this is the format that he uses. So he calls it the five C's. And we're going to talk about how they don't typically come in this order in a little bit. But it's really important for the sake of this narrative arc, story arc discussion to understand this framework. So he uses five C's, and I like these words because it's really easy to remember. So those C's are the current state, which is like the status quo, the beginning, how things are before something happens. That something is the conflict. And conflict, of course, is slightly more complex than this. We're going to get to this in a little bit. But there's a status quo. There's a current state. And a conflict changes that. And then the conflict goes along. And then we reach a climax where the conflict resolves. The tension dissipates. And then we move on to the consequences of that climax resolving and the conclusion. So for instance, and we're going to talk about this structure later, but if any of you guys have heard me talk in the past about what I call the Don George feature formula, the Don George feature formula is all about transformation. So transformation is something that happened on your trip that made you different than you were when you left. So that might be that you think differently about a certain group of people or a certain place. It might be that you've realized something fundamental about yourself, whatever. But there's some difference between you in the beginning and you at the end. That's a really important part of stories, is that something has changed from this current state. And that's why I really like this 5C description, because we have to make sure that by the end of our feature, by the end of our structure, we haven't just given information, because otherwise it's not a story. And I just realized really sadly that I had a slide about this and I seem to have cut it out. So this common trope in theater and film that I hear over and over again when I watch stories on television or in the movies about stories is this description of plot. Okay, so somebody in the film, I just saw this in a film. If you want to watch an interesting film about story craft, there's something called Their Finest Hour. And it's starring a couple big British actors, and it's about propaganda films during one of the world wars. And there's a scene in which they are trying to explain basically writing to one of the new writers. And the guy says, she died and then he died. That's not a plot. She died and then he died, ... of grief. Now that's a plot. Now I've always found that to be a kind of obtuse definition, but it helps you see this thing that it can't just be that this happened and then this happened. There has to be that note of intrigue, why transformation, okay? So it wasn't just that she died of a heart attack and he died of a stroke. It was that he died of a heart attack, or she died of a heart attack. He couldn't handle it. His friends couldn't console him. And then one day he just didn't wake up. He had died of grief. So the whole idea there, and the way that I've described it with several different beats of things that were tried, is what happens in this conflict stage. So there's an initial conflict, which is often called the inciting incident. We're going to get into this in all sorts of pictographic representations in a minute. So don't worry about the terms right now, because you'll see them again. So there's this initial conflict, and then there's several conflicts after it before this climax comes in. And then the consequences, and then the conclusion. So let's look at the images, because like I said, it's really important to grasp this, but it looks like this in the beginning. When I first tell you, you're like, blah, what does that mean? So I have a couple of different slides on this with the different representations of the story arc. And the reason I wanted to start with this one is that I feel like it's actually a pretty appropriate representation of what we think when we're like, oh my God, the concept of story arc, like all of these things happen, and how does that actually make sense? And I love this little picture here. If you can see it, right under struggles and crises, there's a person with some little question marks over their head that says, is all lost? And they're in some water with a shark coming along. And so this is a very madcap representation of what the story arc looks like. But at its core, it's composed of, let's say, this shape, but this is really the current state. This is the conflict. This is the climax. This is the consequences. And then this is the conclusion. So this is the really, really simple trajectory of those five stages that I talked to you about. But here's the thing. As I mentioned, the end has to be different than the beginning. Something has changed. Something has transformed, right? But here's the other thing. If you look at this, or if we go back to this one, it all seems very even. But does the conclusion of the story really ever take this long? Of course not. I was trying to check out this thing on some common stories that have a hero's journey. We're going to talk about the concept of the hero's journey later. And yesterday I was looking at one of the Hunger Games movies, and I had the video, and I was checking where certain things happen in the video. And one of the things that I noticed is that this scene, which seems like it's completely before the action, that there haven't even really been any major obstacles or major anything yet, happens about 15 minutes from the end of the movie. The climax didn't even take place until about 10 minutes before the end of the movie. So obviously this resolution, or like we called before, the consequences and the conclusion have been shuffled into a much smaller space. So this kind of starts to represent it. But this image is kind of getting closer to there, where you see that much less than this very even path here of half of it being dedicated to the consequences, a much smaller bit of the arc is dedicated to the climax, the conclusion, and or the consequences and the conclusion. But this idea of the three-act structure, which those of you that do have a fiction background may have heard before, is still a little obtuse, and particularly for travel features, doesn't really reflect the amount of time spent on various things. So I know I'm going through these slides of the different arcs quickly, but it's because I want to get to the one that I actually like. So we're looking at all the kind of rejects first, but not that Harry Potter is a reject, but I found this somewhere, and I know it's really small, but you don't really need to see what's on it. That's not the point. But the idea is that this up and down can happen way more than this one time. And especially here, this longer three-act structure, it's going up and down. It's not going directly up the whole time. And even here, if you look from where the happiness rating starts to where it ends, it doesn't actually look that different. And in fact, it seems like they're quite low a lot of the time. And this is much more common. Most stories don't have this very clear, happy little stepping stone where every time the protagonist confronts an obstacle, they move up, they move to a happier place. So a very common format that we're going to talk about in travel articles is the idea of a quest piece. This makes the transformation bit very easy because you have set out looking for something, and either you find it or you don't. And you find it and you're happy you found it, or you're not happy you found it, and there's a reason why. But the quest gives your article a structure. And so this is something that, when I talked before about how having these structural tools at your disposal makes your writing job so much easier, many, many new writers don't try this quest format. But if you look in a lot of magazine articles, there's like a preponderance of quests, like a ridiculous number of quests, especially with travel feature books. It seems like almost every travel article is structured as a quest, or every travel book is structured as a quest. And there's a reason for that, because it's very easy. It's very simple in terms of figuring out what these obstacles are. Because if you are on a quest, you're trying to get something, you're trying to find something, you're trying to achieve something. So that's automatically the climax. The point of actually that thing coming to fruition is automatically the climax. Totally clear. You know what your climax is. In nonfiction and real life, there is absolutely no easier way to find the climax of a story, because nonfiction is so much messier than fiction that it can be often hard to pinpoint what exactly is that climax otherwise, but we're going to do some tricks for it later. But with quests, it's so clear. And with quests, likewise, you, for instance, there's a really lovely quest piece where one of the frugal traveler writers, I believe, for the New York Times, had gone to Greece. And he is going around Greece. I think he has a car. Maybe he just rents cars when he needs them. But he's essentially like trying to get from point A to point B, the same trajectory more or less that Ulysses traveled. And he's essentially wandering at the whims of the ferry schedule, and various Greek islands don't allow you to get to another island. You need to go via a waypoint or something like that. And so his quest is to reach this endpoint, right? This city at the end. But along the way, every time he needs to get on a new ferry, or it's a new day, or he needs to find somewhere to eat or where to sleep in each stop, is its own little crisis, its own little obstacle. But they're all feeding into that very clear climax, which is reaching his destination. But like I said, they don't usually take this stepping stone format. And that example that I just gave of the New York Times article is a really good example of this. That just because he's gotten to the next island from the island he was on, which only gave him one option in terms of the next island he could go to, doesn't necessarily mean that he's closer to his final destination, because it might be that the island he's now reached similarly has only one other ferry route that he can take, and that doesn't take him to an island that allows him to reach his destination. So it's not always an upward movement, okay? So the format that I actually like to think of in terms of the visuals for the arc is this, that you start somewhere, you know, your current state is going on, your status quo, and then something happens. And that something that happens is typically exciting, right? That's why we go up a little bit here. Okay, so something happens, it's exciting. You find out about a country that you didn't know that existed, which is a micro country, which is buried in the middle of this country that you're currently an expat in, and you decide, well, we must go and see this other country. Then, obstacle, right? And maybe that obstacle is, despite the fact that there's only a land border, you actually need to get a visa to go to this exciting micro country, and it's a ridiculously onerous process. So then you surpass the obstacle, right? You find a way to get the visa, you're going along, you've rented the car, you're driving there, and then you get to the border and you're told that rental cars can't pass the border, blah, blah, blah. You aren't allowed and you have to stop. So that might be your midpoint obstacle, okay? So then you're like, oh crap, we can't take the rental car. This current trip is scrapped. You have to return the rental car. You go home. You try to figure out a new way to do it. You're able to borrow your friend's car. You're going and you're going and you're going. And then something goes wrong with the car. Maybe you get in an accident and, you know, you are newly an expat in this place. You don't speak the country very well. You absolutely don't know what to do in a traffic accident in this country. And here you are with your friend's car that you don't even own. And maybe you end up in jail. Okay, we're making up a story here, right? So you can go to jail. So then, you know, your friend comes and bails you out. And now the friend is driving the car. It's actually their car. And you get to finally go to the country. And then you have some epiphany. We'll talk about those in a minute. The end, right? So this is the kind of obstacles that can go up and down in a real travel story. But the important part, even though I said you have some epiphany, the end, the important part is actually the epiphany. It's not the climax. So here's the problem with a lot of travel features is that you know what your quest was, or you know what the climax is, you think, but you don't know what the consequences and the conclusion are. And here's the thing. If you don't know those, you can't know any of this, including the climax. You can't know any of these other stages, because if you don't have a conclusion, a destination, let's call it, for your narrative arc, you don't have one. And the destination for your narrative arc is not going to be the same thing as the destination that you reach in your story or your quest. It is that transformation. It is that change from the current state to the conclusion. You have to know what that change is, because otherwise the steps that reach the climax and the climax itself aren't supporting the conclusion you're trying to tell. And that's where you get into situations like, just end with a lesson, a discovery, or a personal transformation. That's how you get into these problems, that the discovery or lesson or personal transformation feels tacked on at the end if you haven't made sure that all of these obstacles and this climax is actually the one that resolves into the conclusion that you want to put forth. So you need to begin at the end. Now, this often ends up with stories on paper, travel features that literally begin at the end, that the beginning on the page of the article is in fact the end of the trip. So there's some ways that we engineer that, like I said, by putting the end of the trip at the beginning of the article. So let's look at how that works. Let's look at some specific structures. So I talked earlier about this concept of the five C's, right? And as we've looked at, these five C's do not get, as in the super, super simplified version, they do not get correspondingly equal amounts of space in your story. So what actually happens is that you have your current state, which should be quite small, and then most of your story is the conflict. And then the climax, consequences, conclusion are also quite small. And the conflict, as we looked at on my, as I mentioned, my preferred slide here, the conflict is actually this whole kind of boatload in the middle of the story. So the conflict has that inciting incident, which is this thing that disturbs your status quo and incites you onto this adventure. Then you have obstacle, midpoint, obstacle, and finally the climax. Now, there's a reason that I have three things in here apart from the inciting incident. And this is because having not three acts, but three scenes or three moments is a very easy way to structure your articles, because it goes back to the story structure that we all learned. Forget about having an MA or even a PhD in literature. We all of us learned this, like at the age of 12, when we were taught persuasive writing or just how to write an essay for school, which was that you have a thesis and you have three points that support it, and then you have a conclusion. I think people call it the five paragraph essay. But we need to make sure this rule of three, it psychologically works really well, but we need to make sure that each of those points, like in this five paragraph essay, truly does support our conclusion, our quest. And then each of these quote unquote points from the five paragraph essay becomes a scene, a moment, an obstacle, like a portion of your journey that we relay, but they must all relate back to the conclusion of the story yourself. Or story itself. So as we talked about, in real life, the stories aren't 3/5 devoted to wrap up. It's really about that middle part here. So I'm in the UK, and whenever I'm in different countries, I always put on the television in the background, not because we don't have television at home, but just because I like the having that cultural exposure of what is normal for people in different countries. So I do it even if it's a non-English country and I don't understand what's on the television. But in the background last night, when I had the television on, there was this Night at the Museum movie, and it was one where they go to the UK, so it was particularly apropos, and Dan, I think Stevens is his last name, from Downton Abbey, was in it as Sir Lancelot, a very kind of ditzy version of Sir Lancelot, and as they are going through the museum, they meet him being a knight. He's like, what is your quest? I will help you with your quest. I am Sir Lancelot, you know, for the glory of Camelot. Tell me what your quest is so that I can help you. And they explain that their quest is that they need to fix this thing so that people don't die. Very, very simple, very typical hero quest, right? This whole thing that happened in the Night at the Museum movie with the monkey was essentially a sort of storytelling ploy to get Sir Lancelot, who's all about the quest, to say, no, 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 we can't also go after the monkey. We are going after the tablet. We are trying to save everybody. Who cares about the monkey? You need to stop following the monkey. And then at the end of the movie, he says, I see now, it was about the monkey the whole time. So what does that mean? Why was it about the monkey the whole time? Because when the monkey went off to save the little people who got pulled into the air vent, it was the same impulse. It was the same idea. It was about saving the lives of his friends, which was the whole idea of the initial thing, which is fixing this tablet so they don't all die at the end of the night. So what I mean by this ridiculous aside about monkeys is that the monkeys in your story, the asides, the obstacles, absolutely every single one of them strictly and 100% needs to tie into the path to the destination and the conclusion. Because if you have a conclusion that seems to anybody to come out of left field, it's happening because your monkeys aren't really related to your conclusion. So obviously I'm not saying that Night at the Museum 3 or whichever one it is a great, great work of fiction. The fact that it was on television at whatever o'clock is clearly a good sign of that it's not. But it was a very apropos example of this story technique and where stories often fall flat, because these little offshoots, these adventures, these obstacles don't actually relate to the conclusion. And the longer your piece is, whether it's a feature or a full-length book, the more likely you are to have asides, to have obstacles, to have adventures, to have anecdotes, to have scenes that aren't tying back into that conclusion. Okay, so basically all of the things that we don't like about mediocre television, you know, a good friend of mine calls these laundry folding television shows. They're the television shows that you don't actually have to pay attention to every single thing that's happening, because the plot is like so clear that whenever you tune in or whatever little bits you hear, it will make sense at the end. Okay, so all of these kind of lazy television things that we don't like, we also need to banish from our stories. One of the main ones is this concept of you need to do X, or you need to get X in order to do Y, which will eventually get you to Z. So this is a really big complaint in the fantasy genre, to go back to fantasy, which is that, you know, you can't rescue the princess because there's a dragon guarding her, and the dragon can only be killed by the collar of Xenon. And to get the collar of Xenon, you have to embark on this entirely other quest to this other place, and all of these other things befall you on the way, and you've spent 5/7 of the book just trying to get the collar of Xenon, and was that really necessary? So people often attack, in the fiction settings, and they come up a lot in fantasy settings, these adventures to get a physical object that you need to accomplish the goal. So how does this work out in travel stories, right? It's less about these obstacles that like don't need to be there so much as background information. I know so many people that follow us and that I've seen at events, I'm looking to see on this call, I don't know if this applies so much to some of you who are on here live, but a lot of you love the history, you love the backstory, and backstory makes for great stories for us. So it's really good to love that backstory. But here's the thing, is that a lot of that backstory isn't going to be involved in, I've got to go back to that slide because it's so appropriate. It's not going to be involved in the particular story that you want to tell in this feature. Okay, so with us, it's less that we get distracted that we need to get the collar of Xenon and all the things along the way with the collar of Xenon, but it's often more to the lines of, I was talking at the week-long freelance travel writing bootcamp with somebody about this, that she is working on a guidebook for an entire country, and she really loves the history. She loves getting to the why of things. And she was having a really hard time with her guidebook and the part at the beginning of each chapter where she gives the background of this place, narrowing that down to like one column on one page or something like that. She was saying, you know, I get into this history and I don't know how to make it all fit, how to explain all of it in that little bit. And the thing is that your reader doesn't need to understand, I'm going to use Spain as an example because I bring this up to people a lot. Your reader doesn't need to understand that in Spain in the 1930s, there was a civil war in which all of the playwrights and poets and artists were just killed in a period of 2 or 4 days and dumped into mass graves. They don't need to know all of that to understand modern Spain. What they do need to understand is what happened after that, and in short form, which is that, well, the rest of Europe had World War II and democracy and modernity and all these things. Spain bypassed that because of this dictatorship that started in the 1930s and went all the way into the 1980s, very much like the Soviet Union. So you can say that in one sentence without having to give them a play-by-play of all of the things that happened in the 1930s, how they finally got out of the dictatorship, exactly how the dictatorship has affected them. So this is the kind of instance in which I see this come up in a lot of your stories, is that needing X to do Y to get Z typically shows up in that background information. So we've already talked about this issue of the epiphany that comes out of nowhere to wrap things up nicely. We've talked about that quite a bit, and I've got a slide, like I said, on endings that we're going to look at. But what I was just telling you about excessive background and how that plays into this trope of needing X to do Y to get Z, there's also just completely unnecessary background. So what I mean by unnecessary background is stuff that seems really interesting to you that has zero to do with the story. So it's not even like it is an underpinning, it is a historical fact. It is something that supports a point that you're saying, but it's a level of detail that we don't know, need to go into. It's background information that simply isn't relevant to the conclusion, right? So it's not that it's relevant to those conflicts or those scenes, but it's not relevant to the conclusion. That's how you know what to cut. But the thing about background is that another very lazy trope is to front load background. And I see this in a lot, particularly of pitches, even more so than stories. And these are often the pitches that die on the vine, where in your pitch, you just have so much information about what the story is about that the editor just loses the thread of what the story is about because you've just told her so much that she's not sure what in particular you're trying to pitch her anymore. So this is front loading. This is where before you get the audience interested, before they have bought into that inciting incident to any of the conflict, while you're still in that stage of the status quo, before things have gotten interesting, you just give them so much information. This is a fate that befalls a lot of novelists as well. And so if you look it up, you can find this front loading of background information online quite a bit. But that's the way that it plays out with your travel stories, is that you're typically trying to put too much background, particularly history, in a sort of explanation-like setting in the front. And this goes into this age-old adage of show, don't tell. So rather than telling people all these things of why they should care, you need to paint a picture and give them some details that create a scene that show them. So we're going to get into structure in a second, but one other common faux pas here that I am, it kind of ebbs and flows, honestly, like how much I see people using dialogue and action in their stories. But characters, I talked about this a lot when we did our series on interviews, which was a couple months back. We had a whole month on interviews. But characters are very, very important. In fact, you know, I was saying that I've read a lot of the long-form travel books now. And I was just looking at one on the plane the other day when we were taking off because I was coming to the UK. My husband has recently started reading a lot of Bill Bryson, who's quite famous, and The Place. And there's very little interacting with the people. And the thing is that in our travel features, it's so important to include characters because they show the place. They show how the people in that place are different than us. So, all right. So we were talking about lazy tropes, but I want to get into how this works in a story format for travel articles. So I just want to, because we had this little pause, go back and revisit what I mean about the time shift here. So I talked about how this is kind of the basic format for how the five C's relate in a travel article, right? And that the majority of our time is dedicated to this middle bit, to number two. But there is a time shift involved. So what happens is chronology. This was something that was discussed on that really first slide when one of the people that I had read online and their tips about travel articles said, structure it thematically or chronologically. And I said, I don't really know how you could structure it thematically and have it still be interesting, but quite honestly, chronologically typically doesn't work. So what happens when we take those five C's that we looked at and spread that out over your average travel article? So it frequently takes the shape of this. And we're going to talk about this specifically in the format of a couple different approaches in a minute. But this is a much more common chronological approach to how that overall story structure, that arc that we talked about, plays out in the real life of a published travel article. So it often begins in the middle. So this is called technically in media res, which I'll type in the chat box because people always ask. So in media res is Latin, and it means more or less beginning in the middle. So this concept of beginning in the middle is something that if you aren't accustomed to writing travel features, you probably often see employed. Like you might see people start with a scene and think, wow, that's great. I need to start my story with some dialogue. I need to start with myself out in the field. I need to start with some action. But here is the trick: to effectively and quickly, without quibbling and without wondering about what part of your story to begin with, the most salient piece of action that you can start with is the last bit, okay? It's the obstacle, this 2.3 here, that comes before the climax. It's the last challenge before your quest resolves. You start there, but you stop before the climax. You stop before the resolution. And then the camera goes back. You go back through history on the little film screen of your travel feature to where it all began. And you explain who you are, why this matters, and specifically why you embarked on this quest in the first place. So that is the inciting incident. But the interesting thing here is that these two are a little bit more squished together. So it's almost like you've got a scene, which is this last obstacle, and then you have a scene where you very quickly, like the voiceover in the movie, explain what is going on as well as why you embarked on this quest. And then that being done, the quest resumes. So you go from the inciting incident into the obstacles, into the midpoint to get back to where your story on paper began, but not where the story really began, because we had that second, if that makes sense. So you start not in the middle, but you start close to the end. And then you go back and you retell the story. And then what happens is that by the time you get back to where you are, like I mentioned about the Hunger Games, it should actually be very, very, very far late on the page of where your story is actually happening. Because as I mentioned, when we looked at those arcs earlier, this climax, consequences, conclusion bit should be a very small piece here, because most of our story, most of the time on the page, is dedicated to showing, not telling. So that bit at the end we were actually telling rather than showing should be quite short. So in the typical travel feature, the climax, consequences, and conclusion should just take up one paragraph altogether. Or maybe if you have a generous 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 words, those can take a couple paragraphs. But usually that bit should all get smushed together. So a couple particular structural approaches that you can use on top of this chronological approach. So one I've talked about before, and I said we would talk about it again today, is the Don George feature formula. So I call that here the fast track to transformation. So the reason that I call it the fast track to transformation is that it really strictly sticks only to that concept of transformation. What for you was the change, and exactly how did you get there? So when you're writing with this approach, it causes the story to come out on the page very quickly, because you can write it in this non-chronological way just to get the scenes out and then move them around. So first you write down that transformation. When exactly did it happen? What did you realize? What was the take home? And then you go back and you write the scenes that brought you there, and nothing else. You don't need anything else. You just need the exact, he likes to call it the stepping stones across the pond in a Japanese garden. Only those rocks that you stepped on. None of the other bits need to be in there. And then you put it into the order, the chronology that works best for you now that you've gotten all those scenes on the page. So another one, which is a bit more, I call the Don George formula, the fast track. The hero's journey is a definitely more complicated way to get from current state to end result. But if you feel like you are nervous about structure and about figuring out what scenes, so to say, what actions need to happen, what information needs to be transferred, the hero's journey can be a very useful thing to check out. So the full version, which was written by a psychologist who studied ancient heroes and their stories, the full version is a 17-step process. And I have a slide on that, but you can find it online if you look up Hero's Journey. And years for a travel article shouldn't be that long, because if you include every single step in this Hero's Journey in the typical 1,500-word feature, it's going to be too much. You're not going to be able to devote enough attention to each step. But the thing is that it is really a no fail in terms of story structure. If you are using the Hero's Journey and you actually stick to it and you make sure that you have checked off all of those boxes, you will certainly have a story. You will have a story with an arc, most definitely. So here is the full version. It looks super small on the screen, and I'm just going to call out a couple of the things on here. Like I said, this is the long version. So it begins with the call to adventure, which is this inciting incident that we talked about, and it has a refusal of the call to adventure. So this is something that we typically don't have time for in our, you know, not little, but in our feature length stories rather than a novel length story. And then in the Hero's Journey, there's all these supernatural elements. So there's this supernatural aid, and then there's something called the crossing of the first threshold. So this is essentially a longer bit. There's several things in here, which are the inciting incident. And then it goes through a series of different trials. And here's why I was saying that if you are really not sure about what to include, that the hero structure does all the work for you. It tells you exactly what type of trials you need to have and what type of people they need to be with. It tells you which characters you need to introduce and what purposes they serve. And it tells you which obstacles you need to have, if there are obstacles where you are having a self moment of realization, or whether the struggle, the issue in your journey has come from outside of yourself. So the shorter version, which I really, really like, I found this online. It's from a website called Storyboard That. I looked at a couple different versions where they had shortened it down, but I really like this one. I feel like it's applicable to a feature length format. And this, like I said, it really shows that only this bit here, which is even probably longer than it is that climax, consequences, conclusion bit. And likewise, the current state is only one piece of this 12-part pie. And all of the rest of this are the adventure, are the obstacles, okay? So the ones in here have the same thing, the call to adventure, the refusal, the mentor helper. I talked about characters and the need to introduce them. This is a really, really great one for any quest piece, is the Yoda on your shoulder who is telling you the answers or the little bits of information that you need to take that next step in your journey. And when you follow this hero's journey structure, it shows you even specifically when that mentor comes in. It also shows you specifically when people who are your quote unquote allies or enemies come in. So there's a story that I think won a Thomas Lowell Award, which was in Afar a few years ago, which is about buying a suit in Naples. So any type of quest where it's a travel story and you need to acquire something, it can be very easy to bring these mentors or these allies or these enemies in. So the mentor is the person who says, you need to go to this shop and you need to talk to that guy. Then the ally might be, you know, that guy who really wants to help you, but he's going away on vacation for 2 weeks because it's August and that's what they do in Italy. And so he says, well, maybe check out this other guy. But then that other guy totally tries to swindle you. So he's the enemy. So when you follow, like I said, this hero's journey, it tells you who you need to include. Now, here's the thing. Does life mirror art? Does art mirror life? Not usually, right? So you might have to dig around a bit in your own story to figure out who that mentor and who that ally really is, okay? And it might not be a person. It might be a website that you found that gave you this bit of information. It might be some other input that acted as that mentor that moved you forward. So you'll often need to dig around to really figure out what were the stepping stones in that pond that took you from the beginning to your transformation, okay? So endings. I pulled a couple lines here from two works of fiction, which I guess we could say kind of have a travel element, but mainly are works of fiction that are known for their incredible first lines. And I pulled them Because it's really important to remember this one thing about the last line. The best last book lines, the endings of the best stories, sound terribly trite without the stories that have brought you there. Okay? So Anna Karenina is known for the oft misquoted first line about happy families being alike and each unhappy family being different in its own way, or the reverse. People often argue about this, so I'm not going to try to quote it. But here's how it ends. My life now, my whole life, regardless of all that may happen to me, every minute of it is not only not meaningless as it was before, but has the unquestionable meaning of the good which it is in my power to put into it. Now, this is the kind of exclamation that if you just say it without knowing what her journey was to get there, carries no weight whatsoever. Tale of Two Cities. This starts with, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. In the end, this is also a pretty famous line, the ending line. It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. It is a far, far better rest that I go to than I have ever known. Now, it sounds theatrical. And that's the thing, is that these last lines, they tend to sound just theatrical unless you know all of the things that it took to get there. So I said earlier that you need to know where your story is going before you start picking out those obstacles and even that climax. And here's the thing. Don't be unhappy with yourself if that place that your story is going, if that conclusion sounds really trite when you just say it, because that's how it is. The ending will sound trite until you put the story leading up to it in place. So don't feel bad if when you begin, it seems like the conclusion isn't a big deal. If it was a transformation for you, if it was a conclusion, and you show the reader, you take them along with you on those steps, it won't sound trite to the end. They will be sitting there nodding their heads along with you. So just a quick thing, because I know a lot of things that we write these days, especially online, are actually kind of a roundup feature rather than a narrative feature. Here's the thing. You can still do this stuff with a narrative feature, or sorry, with a roundup feature. You can still give it some arc, and it sounds totally preposterous, and it sounds even like a waste of time to try to even do that. But if you are in the zone with your writing, where you are writing more of this type of thing, where those 1500 words are composed of a roundup of some kind, this is how you can create clips for yourself that you can use to springboard into better things, is by adding this element of structure even into your roundup features. So how do we do this? First of all, is that we need that thing. We need that conclusion, also a point or a thesis, but we need that destination where our story is meant to end, okay? And then we choose the items that go into that roundup to make sure that they support that conclusion. In the same way that with that five paragraph essay, each of those things that we're choosing supports that conclusion. But here's the thing. How do you order those steps in your journey? How do you order those elements in your roundups? You order them in the same way that you would these narrative features. Now, I know that sounds a bit weird, but typically what happens with a roundup is that you have some things that are stronger, some things that are a bit weak, like maybe some things that show a mix of the current state versus where you want to go. So you might, for instance, have a roundup that is around the concept that a certain city is transforming. Maybe it's becoming hip, or maybe it's got a lot of, you know, craft things that are going in, and you're starting and you're showing how it's becoming like a made in Michigan story of Detroit or something like that, even though that's a couple years old. So as you're telling this made in Michigan story of Detroit, the things that you choose, some of them will be in a state of transition, showing this transition moment. Some of them will be already there, and some of them might be local producers who have actually been there since before this state of transition. And this is really common if you really dig into it in the things that you are including in your roundups, okay, is that they're all at different points in this transition, in this transformation that you're trying to show as your thesis or your point or your conclusion. So then you take those items that you're including. And just like we talked about before, in terms of, you know, you've got the status quo, the inciting incident, the complications along the way, and the conclusion, you order them thusly so that each point in your roundup, even if the person reading it on an airplane because it's takeoff and they can't use their laptop and they're just looking for something else to do, as they follow through the text of your roundup, they are seeing this conclusion of Detroit really being a revolution in terms of things being made in America and homegrown. They're seeing that being built by each point of your roundup. So that's how you can do that, even just with a sort of feature composed of lots of tinier articles. Okay. So thank you guys so much for joining today for this topic that I really love, and have a really great weekend. I look forward to seeing some of you on Saturday. Cheers.